This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. National Train Your Dog Month was started 6 years ago. With so many dogs and puppies finding new homes during the holidays, January is a good time to start that socialization and training process. So how do you teach Fido not to bark at the mailman, chase squirrels, or beg for food at the dinner table, and be friendly with your other pets? Well, joining us to answer your questions about training your dog are Training Tracks co-owner Mel Bussey Silverman, owner of Paws, Look, Listen, Nick Hoff, Dave Groden with Dog Abilities, and Dr. Lisa White, founder of Veterinary Behavior Management Solutions. If you've got any questions about training that new dog or puppy, give us a call at 513-419-7100. You can email talk at wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And Lisa, Day, Nick, and Mel, thanks so much for joining us this afternoon.
Our pleasure.
Thanks for having us.
Nick, talk about benefits of training a dog. Why train a dog? It's just a dog, isn't it?
Well, there are honestly just numerous reasons why we want to train our dog. But the simplest reason is because you want to enjoy your pet. And if you have a well-trained dog, it allows you to have a lot more freedom to enjoy your dog, whether it's going out for an evening or afternoon walk with your dog, or being able to invite guests over to your house without worrying about them getting covered in mud because your dog is overly enthusiastic about saying hello. Training also can help in many areas to help to reduce behavioral issues, as well as help us to obviously treat any behavioral issues that your dog might be having, whether it's anxiety, aggression, or anything else along those lines.
Now, what are your thoughts on this?
Totally agree with Nick. It just makes your life so much easier when your dog is trained, when you can have people come in and out the front door without the dog trying to dash out the door. Or if the dog does get loose, you call the dog to come and he actually turns and comes. House training is obviously very important. It makes your house smell better and your carpet look better. And socialization and training. When you have a well-mannered dog who's well-socialized, you can take the dog where you know, to lots of different places without worry about the dog misbehaving. You don't have to worry, you know, about the dog about the dog biting people. That's a big one, especially socialization.
Huge, yes.
When they're puppies. It's huge. It makes a big difference in their confidence as adults, and their how stable the dog is.
And to add to that, I think one of the biggest things about the benefits of training is that by training your dog, you're developing a relationship with your animal. So it's not just, you know, learning all these behaviors and things like that, but you're actually doing more with your dog. So everything from taking them to different places if you like to do, maybe it's being involved in a sport like agility or fly ball or obedience, rally, anything like that. And certainly just good social manners. That's really what I think most people are looking for the most. So by actually starting that training process very early as puppies and adolescents, you can really start to develop those good foundation behaviors, which will become a lifelong thing for you and your pet.
Lisa, from your perspective as a veterinarian, what do you see as the benefits of training your dog?
Absolutely agree with everything they said. They actually stole most of my answers. One of the things we talk about a lot in veterinary medicine is the idea of the human-animal bond and how that really kind of works both ways to both enhance the animal's life and the person's life. And if you're really going to really build a relationship, you have to put time into that relationship. And those bonds just don't really happen overnight. And you want the animal to assimilate into your life and be a part of the family. So you have to teach them those skills.
So Lisa, how can veterinary care play a critical role in training?
Absolutely. A lot of veterinarians do refer to trainers. The other thing, too, is there are veterinary behaviors out there that if your dog is showing some red flag behaviors of, hey, let's get some help on that. We're showing some anxious body language. Let's really work on that. And two, some of the training with socialization is it's really important that your dog at least yearly be checked out by a veterinarian. And giving your dog the skills to be able to go into the office and not have it be traumatic on everyone involved. One of the huge initiatives that we're working on in the veterinary community, especially the veterinary behavior community, is this idea of a fear-free initiative and really working on trying to make the veterinary experience as comfortable as possible for animals. Now, some of that is work that's done at home, kind of practicing in between with the animal, happy vet visits, working on just basic handling and husbandry skills.
513-419-7100 if you'd like to join the conversation. Got any questions about training your dog? You can also email us, talk@wvxu.org, or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. And let's talk to Naomi in Loveland. Hi, Naomi.
Hi. I just had a question about early to start training your dog to be a service dog.
Okay.
Day one.
Okay. I'll go ahead and take that because I have worked with some service dogs. I think there's a couple ways that you can work with them. Some people opt to actually get a puppy and start from there. So that way they're building a really good foundation with the puppy. Other people like to start at a little bit older age, like maybe 6 months to 8 months, only because at that time frame you get a little bit better idea of the temperament of the dog. So as a puppy, you're not always quite sure how that puppy is going to turn out, but during the when they're actually growing to be six to eight months or even a year, you'll get a little bit better idea of whether that dog will be suitable to be a service dog. And in general, when we do work with service dogs and training them, it does take about a year and a half to 2 years total to have like what we call, if you wanted a public access service dog, meaning that they could go out into the public, be working quite a number of hours a day versus a dog that might just be working in the home and doing certain tasks that would be related to just the home environment.
Lisa, I heard you start to say day one. Was that you?
Yeah. Just in general, with any puppy, it is never too soon. There's actually some good data about starting socialization and handling and exploring different textures with puppies from really day one, and as soon as you get them, there's never there's too young to leave the litter, but there's not too young to start working with them with just really, really basics and things like that. Socialization especially needs to start as soon as you get them. Their primary socialization window is really open till about 4 months or so, a little bit different in some dogs. So really getting them out and getting them exposed to things. Now, the flip side to that being is that puppies aren't fully vaccinated. They go into the veterinarian every 3 to 4 weeks until they're about 4 weeks old. So being smart about where you take them, being smart about being around vaccinated, healthy dogs, and that's one of the great things about puppy kindergarten, puppy socialization classes, other puppies, everybody's healthy, everybody's vaccinated, that you really want to get some veterinary behaviorists will say meeting 100 people in the first 100 days. Now, that's pretty ambitious, granted, but the idea being, hey, let's really get them out and have them kind of be sponges to the environment. Now, the caveat to that being it's always got to be a fun, positive experience. If your puppy's kind of cowering or really, really scared of the situation, we don't want to push too hard, and we always want to keep them happy and competent. Yeah,
and what Lisa said is exactly right. When you go out and socialize your puppy, you want to do it as often as possible without overwhelming the puppy. And you want to make sure the puppy has a great time doing this. So you might bring along with you some, you know, little pieces of hot dog or cheese or chicken, some little dog treats, and, you know, go with the puppy and expose them to all kinds of things. People of all different sizes, people of different races, children, you know, go look at cows from a distance, you know, expose your dog to urban streetscapes and things like that. And watching the puppy carefully, making sure they're having a lot of fun, pairing anything that might potentially be scary with treats to change their emotional reaction to that. And also watching your puppy and giving them a lot of breaks. You don't want to overwhelm them. So if you're, say, going to a farmer's market, I might go in for about 20 minutes, bring a lot of treats with me, make sure the puppy has a blast, and then leave and go sit in a quiet spot for 10 minutes, give the puppy a break, and maybe go back in for another 10 minutes and then take the puppy home, who will then certainly pass out as soon as you get home.
Lisa mentioned a puppy kindergarten.
Oh, yes.
That's a real thing?
Yes, it is.
Yes, it is. Puppy classes are incredibly important for young puppies because, as Lisa mentioned, their primary socialization window closes at about 16 weeks or 4 months. And the primary time to socialize your puppy is during that time. But as she also mentioned, we want to make sure that we do that in a safe and appropriate way. And one of the best avenues to do this is with a puppy class. I think all of us here actually offer puppy classes. Mine is actually called Surviving Puppyhood. And we purposely pair the puppies up with other puppies who are in that same vaccination schedule so that we're exposing them to other dogs that are going to be both behaviorally safe as well as physically physically safe as well as healthy, so that we are making sure that the dog is getting proper exposure to a variety of stimuli and forming positive associations.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation, and let's talk with Tim in Coryville. Hi, Tim.
Hi. I have a dog that I got out of Burnett Woods. My Australian Shepherd found him. And I've had him about 6 years. His extremely traumatized dog. It took me 4 days to get close enough to him to get the chain off around his neck. And now that he's got his courage back, since he, quit being fast, which took about 6 months, now he just goes after any dog that, that he can see. And he just gets, I think they probably tried to face him off in a dog fight or fed him kittens. I don't know what they do to these dogs, but.
So he definitely had a rough life. He was abused beforehand, you're saying.
I'm assuming, yeah.
So advice for.
So I'm wondering how to break him of the habit of being a terrorist, a terrorist.
Well, I did not mean to cut you off. When we're dealing with dogs who have had a traumatic background or just in general who have issues with other dogs, there's certainly a lot that we can do to help them to be able to cope with whatever traumas they've experienced in their past. I think all of us here work with dogs with these kinds of issues, and we can do a lot to help them to learn how to be around other dogs without needing to feel extreme amounts of fear, aggression, and such. But I think one thing that honestly is really important to say is there are some dogs that just don't like other dogs, and it's honestly not a bad thing. I have one dog at home, one of my four, who, quite frankly, he doesn't like other dogs, and that's okay. He gets to have a really great full life, and we just don't go to the dog park. And that's okay. And so depending on the severity of the specific dog kind of helps to adjust our goals and expectations. So with this dog, Benny, I would never want to take him into a dog park situation or even just a social visit with a friend's dog because he just honestly wouldn't really like it. And so because of that, and I know him, I'm not going to put him through that. Whereas other dogs certainly can learn coping skills and the ability to be more sociable with other dogs through appropriate training. And we always want to make sure that we are approaching that with positive reinforcement-based techniques that are focusing on both reinforcing appropriate behavior, but also, more importantly, almost helping to affect the emotional state of the dog so that we're teaching the dog to feel better when they're around other dogs, not just to behave.
Right, and the term for that is conditioned emotional response, or CER, mm-hmm. as we like to abbreviate it. And, you know, you want to work with a professional for this who can guide you, because the devil is in the details, and the little pieces really make a difference. But basically, we want to teach the dog. We want to change their attitude on seeing from when they see other dogs from, I hate you, to, woo, a dog, yay, I love it when I see
it's
other
a new
dogs.
Friend.
Yes, exactly. We want to just. They don't even have to learn to interact with other dogs, but you can teach many dogs to be able to cope in the world when seeing them.
Yes, very true.
We will continue our conversation about dog training, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
And I said, Lord, I'm happy because I'm just walking my dog.
This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. January is Train Your Dog Month, and here to answer your questions are Training Tracks co-owner Mel Bussey Silverman, owner of Paws Look Listen Nick Hoff, Dave Groden with Dog Abilities, and Dr. Lisa White, founder of Veterinary Behavior Management Solutions. You can join the conversation, 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we had a question from Ann on Facebook. What are the advantages of R-plus training techniques? Dave?
Okay, yeah. So I would say within the last number of years, positive reinforcement training has really become kind of a buzzword. And it's great that it's getting out there because I think more people are understanding the benefits of it. So when I look at positive reinforcement training and talking about it with clients, it's not just that I'm exposing a dog to maybe some type of environment or some type of object or people or kids or other dogs. So I'm not going to just say, hey, here's another dog. I want you to be okay with them, and I'm just going to throw treats out. Okay. I'm really looking at the experience of the dog that I'm training. I want them to develop a positive experience to it. Sometimes we have a tendency to push dogs too far, so we kind of end up forcing them into a situation or what we call flooding, where that dog may not be comfortable. And so we think that we are doing the positive thing because we are getting them out there to meet people, you know, meet other dogs. But that dog may actually be very, very fearful or really, really worried. So when I approach positive training with dogs and clients, I'm always looking at the pace of that dog. Is that dog, when I put them in that situation, can they handle that? Is that dog saying, yeah, I really do like people. I'm going to come up and go say hi to them, or I like kids. Or are they shying away, running away? And with puppies especially, I do allow that. I allow that, go approach the people, and then you can move away again. So it's giving the puppies and dogs choices. It's not just about, I'm just going to put you in that situation and you just have to deal with it. So some parts of that's really important with owners too, when they're trying to work with positive reinforcement training, is really to be looking at the body language of your puppy and your dog. You know, are they having a happy time, or is it very negative experience to them? So I think if you can approach all types of training that way, it makes it much easier. And by using things that the dogs do like, we can actually help the dogs develop that positive association to whatever stimulus that we want them to be okay with.
And to working with the owner in general.
Yes.
To listening.
Mm-hmm. We had a caller who wanted us to address separation anxiety and how to deal with that. Lisa, is that something you want to field?
Yeah, let me go ahead and do that. Separation anxiety is a true panic disorder, is a true medical condition, and we need to really treat it that way. And we need to realize that this dog is not doing these things for spite. The dog is truly, truly panicking. Some of the hallmarks that we're going to see with separation anxiety, obviously when left alone, destruction, vocalization, urinating and defecation, and especially destruction around exit points. There is kind of what I call a bit of a sister syndrome with separation anxiety, which is actually a claustrophobia kind of issue where we think it's separation anxiety because the dog's busting out of its crate when it's alone, but really it's just about the confinement. So one of the first steps is kind of differentiating between the two. And I will say those Venn diagrams definitely do overlap. My best diagnostic and really prognostic tool as we move through treatment with separation anxiety is videotape, because the problem happens when we're not home. So what we want to do is set up, and there's a bunch of great webcam apps and nanny cams and stuff like that to really set up and, okay, let's see what's actually going on with this dog while we're gone. And as we work through behavior modification, as we work through medication protocols, that'll tell us, okay, is this working at all? And if it is it working for long enough? One of the most important things, too, that we need to remember is to never, ever, ever punish these dogs. They're doing it because they're panicking. And panic is a really, really powerful thing and really almost a bit of a tornado in their head. And really kind of understanding that this is a panic disorder, and that even if they, you know, tore up your Gucci bag and you've been saving for that and it's your favorite thing, it's not really about you. So really talking to your veterinarian, talking to a veterinary behaviorist to set up a protocol. And the job of the trainer with a lot of these is to, once we get them stable enough that they're able to be left home alone without hurting themselves, to really work on some independence training and helping these dogs learn, I'm okay when I'm by myself. I'm going to be okay.
Mm-hmm. So one thing I would just add to that is one of my favorite ways to help to address this from the start is, as Lisa said, videotaping. Because sometimes I have met with many clients who thought that their dog had separation anxiety, and once we took some video, we found out that the dog had separation fun, where when it was left alone, it was not actually anxious, it was just having a great time. Yeah, and so that's
why. So it's just playing around. Okay.
It is. So that's why we really want to get video right from the beginning. Whenever I have a client contact me with possible separation anxiety, before we even meet for our first appointment, I tell them, get me some video first. I need to see what's going on. And that can be literally as simple as taking your tablet or your phone, propping it up somewhere, and leaving the house for 30 minutes while having it record some video for it. It doesn't need to get too fancy just for us to be able to see that. But we can see destructive behavior, such as getting into the trash. That is not necessarily going to be separation anxiety. It probably just means you have some really good trash. And so we really want to take a look at that. But if it is separation anxiety, we definitely want to address it in the most appropriate way. And you really need to work with a professional for that. It is not something that you are going to be able to go at it alone.
513-419-7100 to join the conversation. And Heather in Liberty Township joins us now. Hi, Heather.
So I had a question for those who choose adoption versus raising a puppy. What kind of suggestions do you have to help ensure successful integration into a home for a dog who may have come from an adoption event or a rescue group?
That's a really good question. So we want to look at making that transition as easy as possible, both having proper expectations for what that dog might be coming in with, because not all dogs who you are going to adopt have behavioral issues or a lot of concerning things, but they definitely may have some manners issues for sure that you want to certainly be aware of and make sure that you are going to be able to address. You also want to make sure that you may not be rushing into it. I'm always a big fan of doing test visits and fostering first before you make that commitment of taking the dog in case it's not going to work for one reason or another. And I also really find with a lot of my clients, there's sort of a honeymoon period after they adopt their dog where they might not see any issues whatsoever for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, and then all of a sudden the dog just turns into a terror, and it's almost like they're changing from the dog that they knew. And it's that kind of that honeymoon period where the dog was getting more comfortable in their environment, and now they're able to let their legs spread out and are able to get into maybe a lot more of the mischievous behaviors that is more typical. And that's why if you start with a training right from the beginning,
yes,
like the moment you get your dog, you should be starting training. I have a lot of people who join class a week or two after they adopt their dog, and it's wonderful because that means we're able to start reinforcing appropriate good behavior right from the beginning, which means that you're going to minimize any possible fallout.
We've been talking a lot about puppies. Day, is it ever too late to start training a dog?
I believe there is no age that is too late to start a dog. Certainly as puppies, it is easiest because as puppies, they're like sponges. So they literally absorb all this information. And they can you can really set foundation behaviors. But, you know, I've had clients whose dogs were 10 or 11 years old, and we taught them, you know, lots of fun tricks or even just some basic behaviors that they never quite got when they were younger. So I think any age is great. It's also great, especially for older dogs who are training, because they're actually having to use their mind. And by using their mind, you're stimulating them. And so that way, it's kind of like a use it or lose it thing. So training is great to start at any age, no matter what it is that you're looking for.
Now, one thing I will just add to that is if you are working with an older dog who has some behavioral issue, you can certainly still address it. But if your dog has been practicing chasing and biting after the mailman for 6 years, it is not going to get better in 2 weeks of training. So if your dog has been practicing a behavior for a long time, and especially if it's been working for them, which usually it is, then it's going to take a while for it to actually be able to kind of change course. And so you want to make sure that you definitely can still address a lot of even severe issues with older dogs, but you want to make sure that you have proper expectations about how quickly am I going to see results and what is that going to look like. And again, working with a trainer is going to be able to really help to give you that perspective that you need and help to guide you in the most efficient way possible.
So if it took the dog a long time to build up the bad habit, it's going to take it a long time rid of it as well. Okay.
It's true. Because what we're looking at in training is something called a reinforcement history. And that's how long has the dog been being reinforced for the behavior. And if they have built up a great reinforcement history, then it's going to take them a while to stop doing that. And that's the same with people. If you have a habit of picking your nails or all kinds of other things, if you've been doing that for 10 years, it's going to take some time and some effort to stop that habit.
513-419-7100 to join us, and let's talk with Jim in Fairfield. Hi, Jim.
Hi, how are you?
Good, thank you.
I have a question that kind of has to do with the old dog training. I share a house with two friends, and one of them owns three little long-haired chihuahuas. And they're six, seven, and 8 years old. But one of them is barking. I mean, every time we live there, and every time we just stand up to walk across the room, the dog barks. Going up and down the stairs, the dog barks. The one dog gets the others barking, but without that, the other two dogs are pretty okay. But, and then when somebody new comes into the house, she barks in a way that it's, you know, it's a distressed kind of bark, like as mm-hmm. if the dog was being stepped on or something. Mm-hmm. But, you know, she's not, of course. But it's like, it's a horrible squealy type thing. Anyway, I don't know. It just, they're.
What do you do?
So,
what do you do?
Lisa?
I kind of jumped on this one. Yeah. So when I see a lot of dogs like this one, the first thing that we need to really evaluate is the body language of this dog. Some of my generalized anxiety dogs do present in this way, that they're just so on edge all the time that mm-hmm. any little change in their equilibrium really sets them off. And what you're describing is definitely a disproportional response to the actual threat level of hey, my roommate got up and got a Coke out of the fridge. That's something that happens, you know, every day. So I would really say that while I do think that training is always a part of things with these dogs and behavior modification, and we've talked about the conditioned responses and things like that, I really wonder in this dog in particular if what we need to address is that baseline stress level, because I wonder if that's what's driving kind of everything, since we are seeing just the reactivity kind of spilling over everywhere.
And then, in addition to what Lisa said, and without seeing the dog, obviously we don't know, but as Lisa said, watching the dog's body language, you have probably the added factor, and I'm taking a guess here, that this dog is probably quite worried about the visitors coming in. You're probably dealing with some fear there. So we had talked earlier about changing conditioned emotional responses to, for example, one dog seeing other dogs. And it's the same process generally with dogs who are afraid of humans. We want to change their conditioned emotional response, and that's definitely where you'd want to work with a professional.
Definitely. When we're dealing with dogs who have any kind of dramatic response to normal stuff, such as a roommate getting up or guests coming over, it's something that you want to work with a professional in order to help to address, and that's something where a proper behavior modification program and sometimes medication can be very helpful. And that's why we rely on people like Dr. Lisa White in order to help give guidance in those situations.
Dave, did you want to add anything to that?
I think everything's pretty much covered on that one. But yeah, I agree with everything in terms of, certainly ruling out any kind of medical conditions that the dog may have. I think when you're especially working with multiple dogs like that, you know, sometimes you actually will need to work with one dog at a time, because dogs do feed off each other. And by actually putting it, training with one dog singly, you can get the behaviors that you're looking for. And then you work with the second dog, do the same thing, the third dog, and so on, and then you put them all together.
Step by step, then.
Exactly, yes. So it's a gradual process with the behavior modification.
Coming up, more advice on training your dog, and you can join us at 513-419-7100. This is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU.
I might be waggy, but I want to play. I'm your best friend, you can get away. I deserve a treat, cause I'm a fluffy babe. I got hair shaking the air, doggy by the day. Because I'm yippee. Rock along if you feel like your master loves you. Because I'm yippee. Rock along if you feel like
your this is Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. I'm Mark Haney. It's National Train Your Dog Month, and joining us with advice, Training Tracks co-owner Mel Bussey Silverman, owner of Paws Look Listen, Nick Hoff, Dave Groden with Dog Abilities, and Dr. Lisa White, the founder of Veterinary Behavior Management Solutions. You can join us at 513-419-7100, email talk at wvxu.org, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. And we had an emailer who says that her 3-year-old rescue won't go outside to use the bathroom. So she's wondering how they can change that. Anybody have any advice, Nick?
Sure. So when we're dealing with a dog who doesn't want to go outside, we want to look at, well, why is the dog not wanting to go out? I've worked with dogs who had anxiety issues that caused them to be too afraid to go outside. And that could have happened due to lack of socialization, or it may have been a traumatic event. I see this a lot after the 4th of July. The dog goes out to use the restroom, firework goes off, and the dog thinks that bombs go off when they go outside to go potty, and they don't want to do that again. So we want to know, okay, is it because the dog might be anxious? If so, we're going to address that in one way. Other dogs can just be a little quirky about it. I have one dog at home who she does not like to go outside with the other dog. She lets them go out first, and then when they come in, she's like, now I need to go. And it can be a little irritating, but we can certainly help to address that kind of issue as well. But one thing that can be really good, this can be especially true if you're having any house training issues, as in your dog is going to the restroom in the house, is go out with your dog on a leash with some treats. And when your dog does use the restroom appropriately outside, reward right there immediately after with a treat. And your dog's going to be much more keen to go outside and use the restroom then.
513-419-7100. Let's talk with Melissa in Montgomery. Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Melissa. I mean, hi. Melissa.
You've been on the phone for a long time, Melissa, so that's okay.
I have.
Thanks for hanging on there.
Thanks. We have a five-month-old, 80-pound Leonberger puppy
who is
very exuberant and great, and we introduced him to our home where we also have a 15-pound, five-year-old cockapoo. And so you can imagine the size difference is quite substantial. I wanted to know what is considered safe play. They do kind of, you know, play with toys back and forth. No one has ever gotten hurt, but I just wanted to know what I can consider safe play and play that I should be concerned about.
Well,
that's a great... Oh, God.
Mel?
Okay.
Go right ahead.
Well, with play, one of the first things to look at is, well, it is obviously safety. You know, it, you don't want the big dog, you know, crushing the small dog. But look at both halves. Are they having fun? You know, if one dog is trying to say, I don't want to play anymore, I'm done, and the other dog's like, no, we must continue to play, then that's something to be more concerned about. If they both keep coming back for more and they are having a good time, as long as it's not getting too out of control, then that's probably fine. If you start seeing arousal levels start to spike up, that's a good time to give the puppies a break and have them chill out for a while. And then once they are calm, let them go back to play so you can avoid having things spill over into possible aggression.
So to touch really... Sorry. To touch on the arousal level, one way that I often tell clients to help to gauge that is as things are getting more vocal, that's an easy way to see that things are getting to be a bit more of a higher arousal. And that doesn't necessarily mean a bad thing, but as things are getting more vocal, you want to watch that. But specifically with the play between a very large breed and a small breed, we want to look at the play style of those dogs. There are different ways that dogs play. Leonbergers, as giant breeds, often will play doing a lot of body slamming kind of play, as well as a lot of mouth sparring is very common. I have four St. Bernards myself, so I see a lot of that. Whereas the smaller dogs are going to often play more like in a cat-like manner. What we want to look at is the Leonberger self-handicapping their play. So are they getting down low on the ground, and are they kind of just flailing their paws a little bit and being appropriately playful? Or is the Leonberger taking its giant paw and trying to squish the little one? If that's the case, we definitely want to step in, because even if it might not be too upsetting to the small dog, it can be potentially dangerous, and you want to address that. One resource that I often send a lot of my clients to specifically about play is there's a really great book called Off-Leash Dog Play, A Guide to Safety and Fun, and that's available on Amazon. But it is a really great book for anyone wanting to learn more about how dogs play and interact together. It is written more for a kind of a daycare professional, but honestly, I've had numerous clients get great, great benefit from it.
Lisa, you wanted to weigh in on that?
Yeah. The self-handicapping was going to be one of my points. If you think about like a high school age kid playing with their elementary age sibling, like basketball or something like that, they're not going to swat every shot away. They're going to not steal the ball all the time. They're going to have it so that they're both participating. One of the things that we look for in what we call a meta signal, just kind of a big flashing light of intention, is what's called a play bow. And dogs are going to put their front arms down on the ground and kind of hop into it and have their butt up into the air. And I know listening to me describe it without a picture isn't great. Just Google dog play bow. You want to see both sides do that. And what that says is, yo, I might put my mouth on you. I might jump on you. I might run around like a crazy person. But I mean you no harm. I mean it as play. Both dogs should kind of do that back and forth as, I want to play. All right, bring it. And then you want to see them about the same speed, about the same intensity. You want to see some role reversals. If you're tally marking, does it have to be exact? No, that definitely doesn't, you know, fit in statistically when people have actually, you know, some poor grad student has done tally marks on stuff like that. But you want it to seem like kind of back and forth, almost like a game of catch or something like that. If the hair on the back of one of the dogs stands up, probably not going to see that in a cockapoo just because of their curly hair. That's their body's way of saying, hey, the brain has checked out. The adrenal glands are running this show. I'm overstimulated. Okay, let's take a break. If one of the dogs is doing all of the chasing and the other one's licking their lips and kind of looking away, they're asking the other one to kind of stop and take a break. So you want to kind of see that. If vocalizations get really high-pitched, really screamy, that's another thing that's going to show you that arousal level's a little too high. Sometimes it can be a stress and anxiety thing. Sometimes, and as the owner of two boxers, I can tell you this, I'm just so excited I can't control myself. Okay, let's take a break and then kind of go from there.
I think a lot of times large dogs don't realize they're large and strong. That's something I've noticed with several large dogs in our family.
Certainly correct.
Let's talk with Kathy in Eaton. Hi, Kathy.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, thank you. Go right ahead.
Well, I guess it's more of a question of how to untrain. I have a terrier mix, and she won't stay away from the heat vent. And I've read, and they say that they were bred to chase away and kill rabbits and mice, which I'm sure we probably have under our house. But she spends hours, and I feel horrible for her because it's taken over her life.
Okay. So
what I put dryer sheets in, anything to get her away from it. So.
So what exactly is she doing with the heat vents?
She just sits and stares at it for hours.
Okay. So.
And sometimes she'll back up when the heat gets on.
Okay.
But other than that, she just sits and stares.
Okay, so my first thought was, well, maybe she just is a little cold and wants the heat, but it doesn't sound like that might be the case. So when we're dealing with behaviors where the dog is becoming almost obsessive, that is definitely a more challenging thing to address, and that's where you want to work with a behavioral professional who can help to take a look at that. Dr. Lisa White mentioned a little bit earlier talking about generalized anxiety disorder. And that may be something that you'd want to look at where you've got a dog who can't stop obsessing. Now, in the meantime, what I will often recommend is if we can feasibly do it, let's stop the dog from rehearsing the behavior in a safe and appropriate way. So if it's, say, one specific heat vent, I would just close off that room, prevent the dog from having access, or maybe set up a playpen or something along those lines to block that area. If it's going to be very difficult to manage that behavior by blocking off access to all the different heat vents, if it's happening all over, then looking at maybe giving the dog specific scheduled breaks where I'm going to go, okay, I'm going to let you go and hang out in your crate for the next hour, and you're going to have a tasty stuffed Kong that's been frozen. So I'm going to take you off guard duty, and you're going to go in here, and you're going to have a nice relaxing time. And just by helping to get the dog to stop rehearsing the behavior, you can actually start to see them calming down a little bit, maybe being a little less twitchy during their everyday lives, and helping to just kind of get a break. But you're probably going to want to, if that does not really help a lot, you're going to definitely want to work with a professional who's going to be able to take a look at that behavior and see what can be an appropriate behavior protocol to be able to help to address this.
Kathy, thank you so much for the phone call. Let's talk with Rick in Middletown. Hi, Rick.
Hey, how you doing today?
Good, thanks.
Me and my wife, we have a 2-year-old Chihuahua, and he's a lovable little dog, but, you know, when it comes to other dogs or other people, he's like, he's crazy. He just goes wild, you know. He barks and growls and acts like he's a pit bull or something. But I just want him to be more sociable. I maybe he's 2 years old, so I don't know if that's very far along. But some of our family members now, he barks at them when they first come in, but he's around them fairly often, so he will kind of settle down and just, you know, he would quit barking and growling at him and stuff. But anybody who's even halfway a stranger, he carries on. I just wonder if there's a way to break him of that.
Hey, you want to try your hand at this one?
Yeah. I know a little bit earlier in the show, we've talked a lot about conditioned emotional responses and trying to change how your dog is feeling and perceiving the people that he is seeing. And so a lot of times we do that with things that they like. So I might pair, meaning that as soon as he sees the person, I might be giving him a reward. We actually use a technique quite a lot that we call look at that game. And it's where we have the dog actually look at the object that they're afraid of or that they may be reacting to. And as soon as they look at it, we mark it. We say, yes, good boy. And then we reward. And what happens is the dogs start to actually look, and then they usually stop that behavior because they're realizing, oh, I might get a reward. So by looking at it and not reacting, they're realizing it's just not such a scary thing. And in turn, what it actually allows is the dog starts to then look back to you. And so then you are the provider of good things, and the dog is looking to you for guidance instead. So we do use that quite a bit, and that seems to help with a lot of dogs. But yeah, so we want to be just pairing all the things that your dog likes motivational-wise. It could even be a toy if they really like toys, tugging, any type of games, that type of thing, and working at the level that your dog can work at. Sometimes your dogs actually need a lot bigger space in terms of when they see the person that they're afraid of. And then as they get better, you can gradually decrease that space. And then eventually that maybe the person could be dropping the actual treat for the dog, that type of thing. So that's just one way that we work with dogs who are reactive to people. And then there are some other ways that we use as well.
Yeah, like Day said, when it comes to working with a dog who's fearful or scared of something, that's almost always the case when a dog is barking and growling and carrying on. Mm-hmm. The key is to keep the dog under threshold, and threshold is that line where the dog will react. For example, they might be able to see a person 200 feet away and be fine, but if that person is 20 feet away, they're going to lose it. So that's the key, is to find a distance at which the dog can see the trigger and perceive it, but not lose it. And that's when you can start pairing seeing the trigger with really good things. And in deep, what's happening is you're applying classical conditioning. We call it systematic desensitization and classical counter conditioning. You are basically changing that dog's conditioned emotional response to seeing people over time, and gradually that threshold shrinks, that distance shrinks, until you can eventually get closer and closer and closer. But a professional helps you work through all the little pieces mm-hmm. that make the difference.
Time for one more phone call here. Let's talk to Margaret in Westchester. Hi, Margaret.
Hi, how are you this afternoon?
Good, thanks. We've got about 30 seconds, so if you can make it quick, please.
Okay, I have a dog that is a Shih Tzu Yorkie mix. I'd like to know how to get her DNA tested for that and for her age, and I want to know why she chews on fabric, and how can I keep her from jumping on people when they come to the door?
Good job getting that question in. Thank you, Margaret.
All right, so with the jumping on people, one of my biggest favorite recommendations is stop allowing it to happen. Put your dog on the leash or put them behind a gate so that they don't have the opportunity to do that repeatedly over and over again. And at the same time, by doing that, you're controlling how close they can get. Teach them to sit to greet someone appropriately. For the chewing on fabric, control what the dog has access to and make sure that you're providing appropriate chew items for your dog, and especially kind of catering to what they like.
What about figuring out the dog's age, DNA testing?
DNA testing, there's a lot of different resources for that that you can look into. I'm not sure of any off the top of my head that are going to be preferred.
Oh, your general practice veterinarian, they've probably got, like, wisdom panels, one that they use as far as it's going to potentially tell you what breeds are in there. They're not super super accurate in all cases in aging the dog. It's just based on physical exam, teeth, eye structure, and again, the veterinarian can kind of help give you a range with that.
Okay, Lisa, sorry, we're out of time, though. Thank you.
Sorry.
No problem. Thanks for listening to Cincinnati Edition on 91.7 WVXU. The producer for today's show, Pete Reitmeier, the assistant producer, Belinda Kai, Stephen Baum was the technical director. I'm Mark Haney.